This is the Andy Pollin Hour on Washington's new home for sports. ESPN 630, the sports capital.
All right, finishing up the week. Tony's got a show today at 11 o'clock. We will get to some playoff preview, and we'll also talk about something that happened 45 years ago today that if you were in college at the time or high school, it probably was an indication of how your social life was going. If you knew what Fantasy Island was, you probably didn't have much of one. And if you had no idea what Fantasy Island was, you probably had one. We'll get to that coming up later this hour. But this was rolled out yesterday by the Washington football team that they are going to have on Friday, February 4th, 2 days after the name change is announced on the Today Show, and they'll unveil the new logo and the uniforms and the whole shebang, that they are going to have what they're calling a park and party tailgate experience sponsored by Bud Light, 6 to 9 o'clock in the parking lot of FedEx Field. They're not going to charge you $45 to park or whatever they charge now. It's been a while since I've been to a game. It used to be $45. No, they are going to have $5 parking to get in there. And they say that the money is going to go to the Washington Football Charitable Foundation programs to support the local community. I will take their word for it on that. I'll get to why I don't think that's such a great idea. But this is, you know, this is again this organization just tripping over itself. yeah, it could be 10 degrees, could be snowing, could be snow. You don't know what it's going to be on February the 4th. And you're going to have people sit in their cars for 3 hours. I imagine they're going to have to keep the engine running just to stay warm. They say that there's going to be all kinds of different surprise moments as part of this. There'll be alumni meet and greets. Well, how does that work? Do they, like, knock on the window of your car and say, hi, I'm an alum. Nice to see you. Do you shake their hand with COVID going on? I don't know how that's going to work. Photo opportunities? I guess you got to get out of your car for that, or will they bring the photo ops to your car? They're trotting out the 3 Lombardi trophies. Okay, you can look at them. They'll have, I would imagine, it's going to be much like a drive-in movie theater, that they're going to show a lot of different things up on big screens that'll be assembled in the parking lot. They're also going to feature the, I guess it's the NFL Films highlight film of Super Bowl 26, which many fans, if there are fans, how many fans are left, hardly remember. Let's see. The Super Bowl took place 30 years ago this month, so you'd have to probably be close to 40 to have any memory of it. You know, I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of us who do remember it. I remember the first Super Bowl, which actually took place in 1973. So it was, 59 years ago today. Wow. When they lost to the Miami Dolphins at the LA Coliseum. They're going to have, what they say are giveaways. I don't know what that's going to be, but they will have food trucks, so no free food. I'm imagining that they're having a big charge for these people who will drive the food trucks to park in this area. They're going to have, this is going to be big, a Mobile Fanatics team store. Yeah, you'll be able to buy plenty of gear. There'll be a DJ and brand-themed fireworks to end the evening. Now, I guess you can't just show up and hand a $5 bill out your window the way this release is worded. Fans can purchase tickets and register to receive a reminder when tickets go on sale at washingtonfootball.com/park-and-party. So you probably have to go online to buy your $5 parking admission to sit in your car in what is likely to be freezing cold for 3 hours while they show you the highlight film of Super Bowl 26 on the big screen, which, by the way, you could probably watch on YouTube if you'd like. It's probably up there as well. So, again, why they had to announce this in New York on the Today Show, I'm not sure, but this is what they've done in recent years because they hate the local media. And rather than do this as a big in-town event, they're going to do it in New York. And Ron Rivera's not even going to be there because he's got to be at the Senior Bowl. And they're going to bring some of the players. I guess Chase Young is going to be there, and Jonathan Allen and Terry McLaurin, and they'll be modeling the uniforms. But instead of making this a hometown, home fan, you know, feel-good event, they're looking for the big national pop, which they're not going to get. You know, it is, I know, a week and a half before the Super Bowl, which is going to be on NBC this year, and that's part of the reason they're doing it on the Today Show. But it's just another slap in the face of local fans. And you got fans are not even showing up for the actual games. What makes you believe they're going to ride out there in rush hour traffic on a Friday afternoon to sit in your car when it's 3 degrees outside and watch stuff on a screen and somehow get a glimpse of the three Lombardi trophies? It's just not well done. They just don't do these things well. And if I were in charge, if I had a say over this, what I would have strived to do, and maybe they did, it just didn't work out, but I would have had something for season ticket holders. If you can't have it in D.C. at Capital One Arena, then have it at Xfinity Center, which is in Maryland. FedEx Field is Maryland. And have it there. Invite your season ticket holders and maybe open up tickets for the public as well. Have a big reveal and name and all that stuff, and have the local media cover it. Instead, you know, some of the air is going to be out of the balloon by the time they get to Friday. And then to do it in this way, which is like, you know, a drive-in, except the weather sucks. I really don't understand it. But, you know, I guess they're going to sell lots of merchandise. All the new stuff will be out, and you'll have a chance to glimpse at the trophies. They used to be really accessible. They're in a trophy case inside Ashburn now, inside the Washington football team's headquarters. But for many years, the three Lombardi trophies were in the window at Duke Ziebert's restaurant, which was at 19th and L. If you're too young to remember Duke Ziebert's, that was the place for power lunches that the movers and shakers of D.C. would have lunch there. Edward Bennett Williams, when he was wasn't exactly the owner of the team. Jack Ken Cook owned them, but he had to do all the formal stuff because Cook wasn't allowed to own an NBA team, which he did. He owned the Lakers and he owned the Kings in hockey and an NFL team. But he used to eat there. And then Cook, when he came to town after selling the Lakers and the Kings and the Forum, he used to have lunch there, and a lot of other, you know, political people and that sort of thing. And it was cool that you could actually see the trophies, even if you didn't want to eat lunch at Duke Ziebert's, even if you didn't like chicken in a pot or the onion rolls, you could look at the three trophies in the case. But that's coming up on February 4th. I wish him luck with that, but does not seem to be as well planned as as some events over the years. Let me get to what Mike Florio said yesterday on the Dan Patrick Show. And it's not really news because we know it's going to happen. But they were talking about records that have been broken this year and whether or not you're going to credit Watt for breaking the sack record. There was a lot of controversy over that and whether or not he broke it in the 17 games and what records are going to mean going forward. And then Dan asked Florio of Pro Football Talk when he thinks the NFL will get to the 18-game schedule.
2030 at the latest, but possibly sooner. Even though the current labor deal with the union doesn't expire until the early part of the next decade, they can do a new deal whenever they want. And I think once they fully appreciate how much money is going to flow from legalized gambling, and you know, New York came online this week with mobile betting and they've made a ton of money already. As more and more states come on board, the money keeps going up and up. How do you make more money if you're the NFL and the NFL Players Association? You increase inventory. You add another game. And then I think they're going to start adding teams. It's not going to be anytime soon, but I think as they understand how much money can be derived one game at a time, one week at a time, they're going to want more. They're going to want to give us more so there's more stuff people can bet on.
Yeah, and the players who may huff and puff and say we'll never accept 18, they'll accept 18 because they accepted 17 when the owner said, how about another $1 billion? And Demoris Smith, who was the head of the Players Association, was asked about that. Well, you know, you guys said you weren't taking 17 games. Why'd you take 17? We didn't take it. We negotiated it. We got $1 billion to do that. So money talks, and look, the money is flowing. Mentioned the ratings for the NFL up 10% this year. And of the 94 top television programs, 75 of them were NFL broadcasts. And that game on Thanksgiving Day between the Cowboys and the Raiders, highest rated Thanksgiving game ever. So it's going to happen. We're going to have 18 games. He says 2030. I bet it happens before that. Weather for tomorrow night, as we have a game in Buffalo between the New England Patriots and the Buffalo Bills. And what they're talking about is temperatures in the single digits with wind chill below zero, 10-mile-an-hour winds throughout the night. Not as bad as it could be, but it's going to be brutally cold there. In fact, on one of the ESPN shows yesterday, Bart Scott, who played for the Ravens and played for the Jets, said what you need to do is to take Viagra. Gets the circulation going. He says a lot of NFL players, at least in my day, took Viagra because it opened up the blood vessels. And, well, you know, it also might create a difficult situation in one of those very tight pants that they wear. He said any NFL player who can't handle the cold is soft anyway. So whatever that means. They did some checking around with some other players over the years. I said, no, we never took Viagra. We don't know where Bart Scott is coming up with that. But here is the preparation for the New England Patriots, and I found this interesting. Mike Reese from ESPN covers the Patriots, and here's how he says they are preparing to play in Buffalo tomorrow.
This is the Bill Belichick philosophy. Like, his team always practices outside all year. The players joke. They're like, hey, we have this indoor facility, but the next time I see the inside of it will be the first time. They were in there like three times, you know, this whole year. So being in the elements, Bill Belichick always says, going into December, November, like, hey, we've seen it all, whether it was rain, wind, sleet. So they hope that sort of not just preparing for it this week, but what they've done all year sort of prepares them for what they're going to face on Saturday night.
Now, remember this. When Joe Gibbs came back the second time in 2004, he said, as long as I'm the coach here, we're not going to have an indoor facility. We play outside in the elements. We practice outside in the elements. And they had some difficult times because there were some like monsoons where they had to find like an airplane hangar to practice in. It was difficult. And when Mike Shanahan came in after coaching in Denver all those years in 2010, he said, No. We have to have an indoor facility. We can't get any work done when the weather's like that. So that's when they built the bubble out there in Ashburn, and that's what they have today. And even at the hint of rain, they practice in there, and that makes some sense. But look, you can't argue with Belichick's success, and he does believe in practicing outside in the elements. And it may not be quite as cold in New England as it will be in Buffalo tomorrow night, but I'm sure at this time of year, it's plenty darn cold. And here's the list of the coldest games on record, and they go in order of least coldest to coldest. The Raiders played the Browns January 4th, 1981, -4 degrees that day, but the wind chill made it feel like -36. The Raiders, though, from Oakland, came into Cleveland and they won 14-12. Mark Van Egan scored a couple of touchdowns there, and they made it all the way to the Super Bowl, where they lost to the Philadelphia, or beat the Philadelphia Eagles, I should say. And then I remember this very well. Remember Tom Coughlin's face, where he was actually told to go back in the locker room after pregame warmups to put Vaseline on his face because it was like the color of a fire hydrant, and it was -4 degrees at Lambeau Field, January 20th. 2008, but the wind chill, they say, made it feel like, what's the number on that, -24. And it also went to overtime, which wasn't great either. Lawrence Tynes missed a couple of field goals in the fourth quarter, but hit a 47-yarder in overtime. And that was the Giants team that went on to beat the Patriots, who were undefeated going into the game. That was the David Tyree helmet catch, and it was almost the Packers. And I think most people did expect the Packers to play the Patriots in that Super Bowl, but the Giants came away with the victory. So that's road teams there going 2-for-2 in the elements. appearance, and here's three for three. Seahawks Vikings, January 10th, 2016, -6 degrees at the time of kickoff. The wind chill made it feel like -25. And remember, this is when the Vikings were playing outdoors at the University of Minnesota because they were building their indoor stadium at the time. So this was an unusual situation. Vikings playing outdoors, and wouldn't you know it, they're in the playoffs in January, and it's freezing cold. They managed to miss a potential game-winning 29-yard field goal with 20 seconds left, and Seattle held on to win 10-9 that day. Chargers Bengals, January 10th, 1982, -9 degrees. Now remember this, this is the Chargers team that had survived against the Miami Dolphins playing what they now call the Kellen Winslow game. Who he was just unbelievable in this overtime game, and it was just brutally hot in Miami, and then they have to turn around the following week and go to Cincinnati. And there are those who say this was actually colder than the Ice Bowl, but they're not listing it as the coldest. The temperature -9 degrees, but the wind chill, they say, made it feel like -59 degrees. And here's this team that plays in Southern California, having just come from South Florida, to go to Cincinnati on what has to be the coldest day on record in Ohio. And not surprisingly, the Bengals won the game 27-7. Dan Fouts, Chargers quarterback, turned the ball over four times. Bengals went on to play in the Super Bowl, where they lost to the San Francisco 49ers, who were coming off the Dwight Clark catch game against the Cowboys. And then the coldest game that most people think of when they think of the cold game is the Ice Bowl, which was played in 1967. Wind chill made it feel like -48. At one point, the temperature was recorded at -18. Packers won 21-17. The thing about this, though, that also makes it even worse than the cold was, the Packers had installed these heating pipes under the field, and they thought, well, you know, this will keep the field nice and soft for the game no matter how cold it gets. Well, it got so cold that the pipes froze overnight after the field had been thawed out, and it turned it into really a sheet of ice. And what Bart Starr was able to do, scoring the winning touchdown, is he found this little piece of sod, which gave him some footing, and he was able to dive over Jerry Kramer for the winning touchdown in what is remembered as the coldest game. You know, as there were a lot of people there, and I'm sure there are people in the Green Bay area who claim they were there. I've never met anybody who says he was there, and I can't imagine being there when it was as cold as it was. Same with Cincinnati, but people showed up. Now we have the other side of the coin. We have Los Angeles, and we have where the weather is great, and they have a dome stadium at SoFi Stadium. And there is concern that for this Monday night game, where the Rams, who won their division, are going to play the Arizona Cardinals, that the stadium is going to be red, that Cardinal fans are going to show up. Matt Stafford, quarterback of the Rams, his wife Kelly Stafford, does a podcast which is called The Morning After. And on her Instagram post, she put up, "Please don't sell your tickets to Arizona fans." Here is her plea on her podcast to Rams fans to do the right thing for Monday night.
I'm not going to lie. I've never seen so many of the opposing team's fans at a game. And we came from Detroit, and there are a lot of good traveling teams there, but that was wild. Like, Matthew is on a silent count. And for those of you who don't know what that is, like, he can't call. It's like a, like when he hikes the ball, it's either a loud count where you can hear him, and that's what usually quarterbacks are on when they're at home, or a silent count. Matthew is on a silent count. Jimmy Garoppolo was not, who's the opposing quarterback. It was crazy. I mean, I've never seen anything like that, but it made it very hard for us because I guess, you know, we weren't expecting to be on silent count.
The sentiment is correct. But Lauren, you're with me on this. She's not making it better for her husband, is she?
I don't think she's making it better for him. But if I was in her position, I would probably do the exact same.
You would publicly?
Yeah. I would like to think that I wouldn't, but knowing me, seeing stuff on the media, I would give myself a platform to back up my husband in any way.
Well, we talked about this in an earlier Kelly Stafford incident this season when she was at San Francisco, and she threw a hot dog at a 49ers fan.
Yeah.
And I think you agreed that you could be driven to that level if somebody were criticizing your husband while you were watching a game.
Yeah, I probably could, especially in the height of the moment. I would hope that I could refrain from doing that. But like I said, we don't know exactly what the words were. So if somebody did push me to the point, 100% I probably would.
Yeah. I would say to her, if I were Matt Stafford, sweetheart, I know you have my best interest at heart, but yeah, you're only ramping this up. You're drawing more attention to this. Mm-hmm. And the Cardinal fans that show up at the game know that they have gotten under the skin of at least the wife, and I'm sure the players on the on the Rams there.
Yeah. Michael would say the same thing to me if you know, yeah, I was in her position. But I mean, again, I feel like this would be a different story if it was a different quarterback's wife. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, Stafford's not, he's great, but there's been a lot of controversy about mm-hmm. how good he actually is. So yeah, if this was Drizelle or somebody else, it would be a little different conversation.
Yeah, and you come from Detroit, where you played a long time. I think you only played in one playoff game. So I know you're kind of new to this.
Yeah.
And, you know, don't poke the bear is the way I would put it.
Right, that, yeah, exactly.
And I think that she's probably not. Her heart's in the right place, but you shouldn't highlight the fact that you've got this gorgeous new stadium mm-hmm. and your team is good. They won the division, and other teams' fans are able to easily get into your
right.
stadium.
Yeah.
I think that's not a good thing. All right, Cowboys 49ers. Here we go again. Nate Newton, who played in some of those big games, was on the morning show today. We'll play a quick comment from him, and I'll go over the history of that as we continue. It's the Andy Pollin Hour, ESPN 630. Tony's coming up at 11 o'clock today. Here we go again. 49ers and Cowboys in the playoffs, and there were two decades where they were regulars against one another, more recently in the 1990s, and back in the 1970s, they played three straight years as well, and they were premier franchises, and it was sort of like Yankees and Red Sox, in that the Cowboys were the Yankees and the 49ers were the Red Sox. It was hammer and nail. There was one year, finally, where the 49ers broke through, but by and large, this has been dominated by the Dallas Cowboys. And I do remember the first time that they met. It was the NFC Championship game, January 3rd, 1971. This was the year before Washington and Dallas played in the NFC Championship. And so this was the Cowboys team that finally went on to win a Super Bowl. Remember, they had all that frustration, losing championship games to the Green Bay Packers, and they lost to the Baltimore Colts the year before when Jim O'Brien kicked the field goal at the gun. They were always next year's team. So 1971, they go to Kezar Stadium. This is before Candlestick Park. They had Candlestick Park built, but it was a baseball stadium. Kezar Stadium was a really old place, and that's where the football team played ever since they had been in the old All-America Conference. And this was a game where you had Craig Morton quarterbacking the Dallas Cowboys, and the Cowboys won the game 17-10, and they went on to win the Super Bowl. Wait a minute, I'm mistaken about that. My mistake. That was the year that they lost to the Colts. So they lost to the Colts that year. They were still next year's champion, but they did beat the 49ers in that game. The next year was when they played for the NFC Championship again. So I got that right. Three straight years. Second year. And this is when John Brody was quarterbacking the 49ers. He threw three interceptions in this game. And the Cowboys ran the ball 46 times, 172 yards, and two touchdowns. And they were able to prevail 14-3. And their defense was really the difference as they clobbered Miami in the Super Bowl. I remember that Bob Lilly sack of Bob Greasy was just, I think it was like about a 40-yard sack or something like that. I don't think it was that long, but it was an unbelievable play, and Dallas was just dominant that day, and they finally broke through and won the Super Bowl. The third straight year that they met, December 23rd, 1972, that was the week before Dallas came here and played for the NFC Championship on New Year's Eve. San Francisco, and this was classic Roger Staubach, San Francisco held a 28-13 lead late in the game, but Roger Staubach made his first appearance as Captain Comeback in this game. This was his first great comeback appearance. 17 unanswered points in the fourth quarter. Tony Fritsch, who later kicked for the Houston Oilers, he was he's the only kicker I can remember. Well, I guess Tom Dempsey had a big gut, but he had a pot belly. He had like a beer belly, and he was bald and built kind of like an egg. But in this game, he made all six of his field goal attempts and three of his extra point attempts, and the Cowboys won the game 30-28. They had basically the Cowboys ran out of gas in that game, and they went on to play Washington in that championship game, which Washington won rather easily. They won it 26-3 as they beat the Cowboys and went on to the Super Bowl. Jen, then we get to the 80s. Now, this is the game that we talked about, the 40th anniversary earlier this week, the NFC Championship game, Dwight Clark and the catch, and the 49ers go on to win 28-27, and they go on to play the Cincinnati Bengals, who had just come off that brutally cold game where they beat San Diego to get to the Super Bowl, and that's where Joe Montana won his first Super Bowl championship. Then they meet again. This is where we get to three straight in the 90s, and this is the really memorable part. January 17th, 1993. So this is the first Jimmy Johnson Cowboy team. This is the one that the year before had made it to the playoffs for the first time after the 1-15 start, one first year start in 1989. 1990, they were a little bit better, and then 1991, they were a team that got to the playoffs, but they lost to the Detroit Lions, who came here for the NFC Championship, which was won by Washington. So they get back there. This is 93. And this is the team that had opened the season by beating Washington on Monday Night Football. And in fact, the last game that they lost was a wild game at RFK Stadium, where there was a fumble in the end zone by the Cowboys, which was recovered by Danny Copeland. And then they went on to go through the playoffs. So they're playing the NFC Championship game. And the 49ers had been the most successful team of the 80s, but the Cowboys were there. And these were wet and muddy conditions at Candlestick Park. Now, this game almost took place in Dallas. Washington had played, this was the last year of Joe Gibbs won, the last game of the Joe Gibbs won tenure. They had played at San Francisco after beating Minnesota in the wild card game. And they had a chance to win this. They were way behind, and they had the ball inside the 10-yard line at San Francisco. And to this day, there's an argument as to who actually was responsible for the fumble, but there was a handoff from Mark Rippon to Brian Mitchell, and the handoff was botched. San Francisco recovered, and they were able to hold on for the win. Had Washington won that game, they would have gone to Dallas to play for the NFC Championship the following week. Instead, they go to San Francisco. Now, the field was such a mess that they had to put in new turf, but the new turf really hadn't taken hold, so it was really a muddy mess for this game. But the Cowboys were able to win it 30-20. As Troy Aikman and Emmitt Smith were at the top of their game, and they were just able to simply run the football, and they went on to clobber the Bills in the Super Bowl in Los Angeles. Then they meet for a second straight year, January 23rd, 1994. This is the second of the Jimmy Johnson Super Bowl championship teams, and during the week, Jimmy Johnson had called into Randy Galloway's radio show. Gallo was like the top guy at the time. He was sort of the Tony Kornheiser of when Tony was still at the Post of Dallas at the time. He had a newspaper column in the Dallas Morning News, and he had a very popular radio show that he did in the evening. And Jimmy Johnson was driving home from the facility, and he heard them talking about the game, and he called in and he said, "We're going to win, I guarantee it." And people went, "Whoa, Jimmy, what are you talking about? These 49ers are pretty good." And sure enough, the Cowboys go into this game, and Troy Aikman suffers a concussion in the first half. He's knocked out of the game. Bernie Kosar comes in and takes advantage of what Aikman had built. They built a 28-7 halftime lead, and they were able to win this game 38-21, and they went on to play Buffalo again in the Super Bowl in Atlanta, and they won that. The third of the three straight games that they played in the 90, this is finally the one where the 49ers broke through. January 15th, 1995, it's played at Candlestick Park, and San Francisco gets off to an early lead, 21-0. Cowboys cut it down to 10, but that's as close as they got. 38-28 was the final score, and that was the San Francisco team with Steve Young, and they got to the Super Bowl, and they were able to beat the Chargers easily. That was, I think, Jerry Rice had 5 touchdowns in that game, something like that, maybe 4, but they had 6 touchdowns against San Diego. They're just raining touchdowns, and that was the championship that Steve Young won, and that's the last time that they have met in the playoffs. So now they're back at it again. It's obviously much less than it was then as an NFC championship game, but it is a playoff game, and the 49ers are fortunate to be there after they were able to beat the Rams in overtime last week. So now we look at the Cowboys, and the Cowboys won their division, bad division this year, won it easily. The question is, are they built now to go on for a long time? They've got Dak Prescott on a long-term contract. They've got some younger players, but they're bumping their head on the salary cap. And Nate Newton, who played in all 3 of those games I just described in the 90s and won 3 Super Bowl championships with the Dallas Cowboys, was on the morning show with Keyshawn, J. Will, and Max this morning and talked about the window that is there for the Cowboys and also how they are preparing for this game.
We watched them the other day. You know, they had on them full pads. I mean, I know it's late this season, but they had on full pads, man, just picking up the tempo, not so much as hitting. You know, but putting on those pads, man, and going full tempo at trying to get this thing done.
If the Cowboys, Nate, don't make a deep run in the playoffs and even advance to the Super Bowl, for that matter, based on the economics of the quarterback and the running back and all the money spent on the offensive line and the receivers and whatnot, is this a situation where that window is going to slam closed on them for the next several years?
You know what? I want to say no, but when you look at what is happening here, we've got a bunch of players on defense that are on a 1 or 2 year contracts. We had a coach and Coach Quinn, the defensive coordinator, to come in and put this package together because they allowed him to bring in players, to put players in place, to have a vision. Coach Quinn may be gone. These players may be gone. Defensively, and that's been our Achilles heel, even though it's a strength right now. That's been our Achilles heel. If they don't win this thing or go deep into the playoffs, man, the window will probably start slam shut.
Yeah, so they mortgaged, and you know, this is what the Rams have done too. They mortgaged draft picks, and they've hit their head on the salary cap as well. So this is a go for it year, and be interesting to see where these two teams are like 3 years from now. One other Cowboys note: this reported today by Todd Archer, ESPN. Amari Cooper fined $14,650 for violating COVID-19 protocols for unvaccinated players attending a Mavericks game this past week and not wearing a mask. Now, Cooper missed a couple of games earlier this year after testing positive for COVID, games against the Chiefs and the Raiders, and apparently is unvaccinated. This is going to be something to watch as the Cowboys, if they do advance, where they go and, you know, whether or not he's going to get this, because other players who have had the vaccinations, have had the boosters, they follow different protocols, and he's now, you know, violating that, going out in the open where this Omicron is spreading like crazy, and they need Amari Cooper, okay? And they paid him a lot of money to hang on to him. So that's a clip and save, as we say. We'll keep an eye on what's going on there. One other thing here before we get to break, I want to get to Fantasy Island and the anniversary of that. This assistant coach at the University of Maryland, who was now suspended for a game, for a month, Bruce Shingler, is 40 years old. He came to Maryland on a 1-year deal for $300,000. This guy making $300,000 a year. During COVID, He gets arrested for, as is reported here in the police report, apparently soliciting an undercover police officer posing as a prostitute. And according to the report, confirmed that he wanted to engage in sex in exchange for a fee of $80. And he's due to go on trial on February 28th. Now, the school can fire him with cause, but they first must receive written notice and have an opportunity for him to meet with the athletic director. So maybe they're just going through the procedures. The problem is that they're down assistant coaches because Mark Turgeon resigned earlier this year. And that left Matt Brady, who's been with the program since 2017, but Danny Manning, who was the top assistant, now gets elevated to head coach. They had to move Greg Manning Jr. Remember, his dad played at Maryland late 70s, early 80s. He's the team's director of operations. He's now an assistant coach. So they have only two assistant coaches, which may not seem like a big deal to you. It probably isn't that big a deal, but in college basketball, you'll sometimes see like four and five assistants sitting on the bench. Turgeon had lost a couple of guys, Beno Ranson and DeAndre Haynes. They had left last season. So, you know, what is this guy thinking in during COVID? He's out soliciting a prostitute who turns out to be an undercover cop. He's making $300,000 a year. and he's obviously looking to advance his coaching career. He'd spent 5 years working at South Carolina before coming here. He's from this area, from PG County. He worked at Towson and Morgan State. A guy looking to launch a career. Looks like he's going to be one and done here and maybe sooner for doing what appears to be a very, you know, if guilty, it's alleged, but if guilty, doing a very, very stupid thing on a variety of levels. Soliciting a prostitute, an undercover cop, during COVID. Smart. Real smart. As if Maryland doesn't have enough problems of its own. Now you got an assistant coach being an idiot, it appears. Coming up, we'll get to what happened 45 years ago today, and I'll explain the significance of the debut of Fantasy Island as we continue. It's the Andy Pollin Hour, ESPN 630. All right, we got Tony to round out the week coming up at 11 o'clock. It was 45 years ago today that Fantasy Island made its debut on network television. It was on ABC. And this was pre-cable, pre-Netflix. So working actors were kind of limited in where they could work on television because if you didn't have a series, you know, what did you do? So there were a lot of actors who had been in sitcoms, which are no longer on the air, or maybe they were even in a sitcom, but were looking for extra work. And there were two shows, Fantasy Island and The Love Boat, where you could do this. You could play a character who comes on The Love Boat looking to find love on this cruise, or you could come to Fantasy Island and all your dreams can come true. And it actually started, I had forgotten about this, it started as a made-for-television film, which they put out on this day in 1977, later in 1978, and then the series ran from 78 to 1984, and it ran on Saturday night. And I was in college at the time, and I remember this, if you had a good social life, you had no idea what Fantasy Island was because people didn't have VCRs. They couldn't record the show, so you either saw it live or you didn't see it. And, you know, if you were like me, you could remember every episode and every character. You were home on Saturday night watching Fantasy Island or The Love Boat, as Janice Ian sang, those of us with ravaged faces lacking in our social graces, this was entertainment for us on Saturday night. And the show would begin, and everybody who had seen it would remember how this exactly how this began. The show's main character was Mr. Rourke, played by Ricardo Montalbán. Ricardo Montalbán had this wonderful accent, and at the same time, he was doing these commercials for Chrysler that would always appear on NFL games, and he would talk about the fine Corinthian leather. What the hell is Corinthian leather? Nobody knew, but they had leather seats in the car, and it sounded better to say fine Corinthian leather rather than to just say leather seats. And the premise of the show was they would fly in these characters to Fantasy Island, and it would be Tatu, who was played by Hervé Villechaize, who was a dwarf. It was his job to alert Mr. Rourke that the plane was coming in and that they should prepare for the landing and to greet the guest. And he would ring a bell in the bell tower. So this is how every episode of Fantasy Island began.
Our guests are arriving on time, to the second.
They always do. And you always act like it's a miracle.
My dear Tattoo, when each guest is paying $50,000 for a three-day stay on Fantasy Island, he or she deserves miracles.
Right, boss.
Right, boss. The plane. If you said the plane, everybody knew what you were talking about. Then the plane would land. And the guests would come off the plane, and Mr. Rourke, always wearing a white suit, white shoes, perfectly white clothing, would say, "Smiles, smiles, everyone." And then Rourke would describe to Tattoo the nature of their fantasy, usually with a cryptic comment suggesting the person's fantasy will not turn out as they expected. Rourke would then welcome his guests by lifting a glass and saying, "My dear guests, I am Mr. Rourke, your host. Welcome to Fantasy Island." They had a strict moral code, and he tried to teach his guests important life lessons through the medium of their fantasies, frequently in a manner that exposes the errors of their ways. On occasions when the island hosted terminally ill guests, he would allow them to live out their one last wish. It wasn't a comedy. It wasn't really a drama. It was, kind of in between. With only a few exceptions, Mr. Rourke always made it clear that he was powerless to stop a fantasy once it had begun and that the guests must play them out to their conclusion. I know nobody died during these fantasies. They were always rescued. But that's how a lot of guest stars, made a living. You appeared on Fantasy Island, and you got to see your fantasy either play out or not play out. And if it didn't play out, there was a reason. Or, usually it was something that you wanted, and then the reality was in the end, I really didn't want that. And that's what Fantasy Island was all about. So if you remember Fantasy Island from the 1970s, it all started on this day in 1977. I forgot to mention the David Culley situation, fired yesterday as coach of the Houston Texans. And, he did take the job knowing the Deshaun Watson situation. So it's not like, he took the job and found out, oh, God, it's not what I thought it was going to be. Like the Bobby Petrino situation when he took the Falcons job and then Michael Vick went to jail. It was a little bit different. He wimped out and he resigned with three games to go, but it was a little bit different. In this case, this was a job that, from all indications, the Texans knew was going to be a one-year deal. And they weren't going to keep him. They only gave him a two-year contract. But the contract is supposed to pay out close to $17 million, according to one report. He may get another $8 million. But he's going to make some money. He's going to be 67 years old in September. He's been a career assistant coach. He has been, I guess, a head coach at Vanderbilt in college, but in the pros, career assistant. And I guess he finally got to cash in. I would say this. This is awful because it addresses what a mess it is in the NFL that we're now down to just one African-American coach in Mike Tomlin. And clearly the Rooney Rule has failed. It was well-intentioned, and for a while it was working okay. But now it's not working at all. But the bigger issue is this, and Jerry Brewer writes a good column about this today, that it's where the African-American coaches are getting opportunities. And they're only getting opportunities in bad organizations. Tomlin is an exception. Tomlin has proven to be a great coach, probably a Hall of Fame coach. He's won a Super Bowl. He's won, I think, 168 career games. But he's gone to the most, or at least one of the most, stable organizations in sports. He's only the third coach they've had since 1969. And he took over for a coach who retired in Bill Cowher, who had won a Super Bowl. And it wasn't a situation, oh, God, we got a clean house, we got to find somebody. He walked into a good situation. And as Jerry writes in his column today, the NFL suffers from systematic racism and debilitating ineptitude. In any given year, at least two-thirds of the franchises are embarrassing and clueless, living off fan obsession more than astute organizational practices. And here's a guy who walked into something that was nothing like that. And that's why he's been able to succeed. It's going to be interesting to see where African-American coaches land. And, you know, the Bears at times have been dysfunctional, have been okay. So maybe Brian Flores lands there and does a good job with them. And he's got a quarterback there that he can develop. And maybe that is a situation where he can succeed. But that's been part of the issue, too. And another leftover from the week that I meant to get to. Now, Alabama lost to Georgia in the championship game, but there was a story I've been meaning to talk about from SI.com, and it's written by Ross Dellinger. It's about Pete Jenkins, who's an unknown assistant on the Alabama staff, and every one of these great coaches has a guy. There's just Ernie Adams was a Bill Belichick, or it maybe still is a Bill Belichick guy. When Bill Parcells was coaching the Giants, he had Mickey Cochran, who was his high school basketball coach. And Mickey Cochran had played for Vince Lombardi at St. Cecilia High School. And that was like his guru guy. And Pete Jenkins is the guru guy that nobody knows about for Nick Saban. He is one of the founders of the 3-4 defense. They've had a 22-year relationship, which dates back to his days at LSU. And in 1999, Hank Tierney, who is a high school coach in Louisiana, walks into Saban's office, writes a name on a blackboard, Pete Jenkins. And he said, "You want to turn things around? This is the guy you hire." Brings him in at LSU. He worked there for 11 years, then retired at the age of 60, and then came back to coach at LSU when Ed Orgeron was there, and then became a defensive line coach in Philadelphia. Now he's back with Saban, and here's what he says about working with Saban. He says, I hope that he doesn't call and say, "Pete, what I need you to do is go kill somebody. I don't want to spend the rest of my life in jail because I'd kill for that SOB." So, you know, these are the guys who are behind the scenes that nobody knows about. You know, you see these guys on the sidelines that they talk about. Oh, yeah, he's an up-and-comer. He's going to, you know, gonna become a head coach at some point. No, this is an older guy who's sort of like Nick Saban's whisperer. And a lot of successful people have somebody like this. And, you know, Mickey Cochran, I remember when he used to travel with Parcells, they would go on all the road trips together. It was like his guru guy. And you know, when you peel away the layers of the onion and you find out what makes these guys successful, a lot of them have these guys who keep them grounded, older guys. And I thought it was a very, very, you can look it up online. It's written by Ross Dellinger. It's when Nick Saban calls, he answers. And it's about Pete Jenkins, who's on that staff. Fun stuff. Okay, Tony's coming up next, and I will be back on Monday, hopefully with the weather, but we'll have a 10 o'clock show then. Thanks to Lauren Dernham for running the show. Thanks to all of you listening. Tony's coming up next right here, ESPN 630.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.